Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Literacy View. We have a really special show for you today. We have Dr. Holly Lane. Yay, Holly. And so let me give you a little information about Holly. Dr. Holly Lane is a faculty member at the University of Florida and director of the University of Florida Literacy Institute, UFLI. Her research focuses on the prevention of reading difficulties through effective early literacy instruction, the remediation of literacy skills for students with dyslexia, and methods for helping pre-service and practicing educators develop the knowledge and skills they need to be effective reading teachers and interventionists. Dr. Lane has directed many grants to support reading research and the development of teachers and researchers. She is also the author of numerous publications related to literacy, including UFLI Foundations, an Explicit and Systematic Phonics Program. So thank you, Dr. Lane, for being here with us today. And the focus for this conversation will be, does expensive mean better quality? And the reason we are having this discussion is because Judy and I noticed in a Facebook group that you commented, I don't recall the context of the whole thing, but you told a story that made me smile. And I said, oh, we have to get Holly on and talk about this. So would you mind starting off telling the listeners the story that you wrote in the comments?
Sure. And thanks for having me, ladies. It's nice to be here.
It's our pleasure. Thank you.
So I don't remember the exact context either, but it was something about programs being expensive. And I related a story, and it was kind of an analogy in this context, of something that happened to me a couple of decades ago now. But my husband and I were trying to sell a car. It was the car that I had had since I was 16, and it was probably, I don't know, 15, 18 years old. It was a bit of a rust bucket. So we were just wanting to get rid of it and didn't really want a lot of money for it. But, you know, we were grad students at the time, and we thought, okay, we'll just put it in the paper. This was back in the days of classified ads. I'm dating myself here. But we put it in the newspaper one weekend for $500. We thought, surely it will sell quickly at that price. Well, it didn't sell. And so we put it in the paper again the next weekend, and it didn't sell. I think there were 4 or 5 weeks in a row we put it in the paper. It was almost getting to the point where the cost of the ad was going to be more than what we would get for the car. But eventually, my husband decided to try another tack. And he said, I put it in the paper this week for $1,500. Well, at about 7 o'clock Saturday morning, we got the first phone call. And by 8 o'clock, the car had sold. And by the end of the weekend, with the ad in the paper, we had gotten at least 30 or 40 calls. It was the exact same car. And his rationale, which looking back is, it both makes sense and is kind of sad, was that it was all about perceived value. People wanted a cheap car, but they didn't want a $500 car because that's got to be garbage, right? And certainly a $1,500 car would be better. And my guess is they were scanning the ads and just dismissing the cars for a few hundred dollars and were saying, you know, somewhere in that neighborhood is what I want to spend. So anyway, it just struck me so much that mentality, that is somewhat human nature, that we equate cost with quality. And as I see schools and districts paying millions of dollars for big, fancy, fluffy curricula programs, the It just keeps coming back that we assume that if we're being charged a whole lot, then it must be good. And it's kind of disheartening that that's happening, because I would rather see those millions of dollars go toward increasing teacher pay or getting materials that are maybe less expensive, but more effective. And it's just seems like it's a growing problem. And many of the programs justify these astronomical costs by stuffing them with lots and lots and lots of materials. Way more materials than a teacher could actually ever use. So it's left to the teacher to sift through all of this, usually without any guidance from the program itself, to determine what are the essential pieces and what are the optional pieces, or which pieces should be used with which students under which conditions. There's hardly ever any guidance for that. It's just, here's a smorgasbord of everything. And certainly that makes it worth a lot of money. So anyway, I feel like this is an ongoing problem. And, I shared it kind of as an offhanded comment, but I'm glad that it resonated with you.
It certainly did. I think we see this often, and more so lately in the conversations that I'm seeing. I mean, I don't think there's a day that goes by that we're not seeing questions about this all the time. So, Judy, you're in the schools now, and certainly these core curricula have lots and lots of materials. What are the teachers doing to kind of sort through this? Or is this kind of like doing it as you get it, you're learning as you go? How are you handling that right now?
So from what I'm seeing, teachers are really frustrated right now. They're having a hard time. They're very overwhelmed in general, citywide, nationwide. They've been given these quote unquote research-based programs that are being, and they're being told that this is a curriculum. So there's still a lot of confusion in the field between what is a curriculum versus what is a program, right? A program is a resource that we have to pull from. I learned that very well from Maureen Ruby, our recent guest. But I think it's problematic because, like Holly just said, and Holly, I am your biggest fan. I pre-ordered that UFLI book way before everybody else. I was one of the first. What a wonderful, wonderful resource. I appreciate you.
And I have my copy here as well.
Excellent. Excellent. That's a noble company because you guys even list decodables from other publishers. You have slideshows that are ready for people. But anyway, going back to what I'm seeing in the field, I think teachers are very frustrated. I think it's very hard because teachers, get evaluated on using programs that are that kids are having a hard time with, right? Because in K-2, one of our main goals should be teaching the kids how to read and write. I don't care if anybody wants to argue with me. Yes, knowledge building is important, but a big, big priority is making sure kids can read and write. And what I'm seeing in the field is not enough attention to kids reading and writing as we've shifted to the science of reading or whatever we call it, snake oil or whatever. It's kind of like really upsetting because, I'm seeing first graders. I know, I looked at Acadian's data for my friends and I. We had Acadian's parties and the data is looking very low for a lot of kids right now. And it's not because they're not doing their phonics programs. And it's, and many schools are now incorporating phonemic awareness, but we're really not budgeting our time well enough to have kids reading. So we're doing so much of this quote unquote knowledge building, which is questionable because I don't know how great that's going, because now we all think that these magic boxes have the magic solution. You know what? I taught knowledge building without a magic box. There were videos, there were experiences, there were trips that we went on. But I think right now everybody's looking at these boxes like there's magic in them. And sometimes the magic doesn't have to cost a lot of money and can be way more efficient. So I'm really worried.
Yeah. So, Holly, it's very interesting what Judy's saying. You could hear the frustration, obviously. This is a conversation that keeps coming up. So it made me think of something that I saw in the news, and I'm sure you've heard, Iris Apfel, the fashion designer, the interior designer, that elderly woman with the big glasses, and she would wear the colorful clothes and lots of jewelry. And, you know, she was really this fashion icon. And she said that she preferred flea market finds to exclusive brand names. And it made me think, well, how do you find those treasures? How do you find the flea market treasures and, you know, prioritize that and say to yourself, well, you know what, this is good stuff. Like your $70 manual, this U-Fly is good stuff. How do teachers, how do administrators find those flea market treasures?
Well, it really does boil down to having a good understanding of what they're looking for. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I love going thrifting, right? And finding those treasures. And sometimes it is a designer brand for a good deal, but a lot of times it's just something different and unique and something that fits the need. And that's really what it boils down to, I think, is for looking at for reading programs, is what is fitting your needs and what has maybe way more than you need, or maybe different things from what you need. You know, I don't think there is one program out there that's going to be the best one everywhere for all kids. So you do need to know who your population is, who you're serving. You know, I heard Kareem Weaver recently talk about, you know, that these programs that require lots and lots of sorting through materials might be fine in a district where teachers have, you know, an hour or two or three of planning per day, where there are other districts where a teacher might have 40 minutes of planning. And that's just completely unacceptable in that kind of setting. Teachers don't have that much time to go through it all. And maybe it is a better program if you can use all of the pieces and figure that out. But without the guidance from the publishers on how to implement it and which things are the essential ones and which things are the optional pieces, then that's all up to the teacher to sort through. And most teachers don't have that kind of time. I mean, the districts that have a couple of hours of planning a day are, I think, few and far between. So, you know, why are we getting so far into using these programs that are just bloated, as they say?
Well, here's the issue that I think everyone is finding. They don't know who to trust. They're jumping at buying these programs. And as Judy said, they are hoping for the magic box to just present everything to them that they need. And then they get it and it's overwhelming. So Judy, let's talk a little bit about perception. All right. So, you know, I think you and I have talked about what's going on with the conversation with Ed Reports and then this Curriculum Insight Project. And then the Reading League has their guidelines that just came out. So, you know, what are we going to do as far as helping teachers just sift through this and know what to look at and who to trust? Mm-hmm. Like, what are some of your thoughts on that?
Wow, that's a big one, Faith. So I think that what I learned, again, from Maureen Ruby, was that it takes really a while to come up with a really good curriculum. So you sift through the program, you see what's working, you see what's not working, you're seeing which standards the kids are having a hard time with, and you start to prioritize. But developing a quality curriculum, either on the district level or on a school level, takes a lot of, you know, a labor of love, right? There has to be communication with the teachers in the field. They know more than anybody else what's working, what's not working. These people that work for publishing companies, a lot of them are detached from the classrooms. They're not the boots on the ground. So we have to start talking to our teachers. They see what the kids are producing in that independent task. When kids are given tasks, that's a mirror of what the teacher showed me, something that I could do on my own. And guess what? A lot of these curriculum companies are creating tasks that are not developmentally appropriate. Kids are struggling. I hear the word mini lesson still all the time. Why is it a mini lesson? There's nothing mini about showing kids how to do something. And there's also no rush to do it in 3 minutes. I showed you something today. We're going to do it together. You're going to do it on your own. You might have still had trouble with that. I might have to go back to it tomorrow. But I think that now people are so, you know, obsessed with this F-bomb, the fidelity bomb, that they think they have to take these programs and do every lesson and not change anything because fidelity, fidelity, fidelity. But there's kids in front of us. And what I'm noticing in the field right now, everywhere, whether it be with my private clients that I tutor and kids in schools, kids are not learning how to read if we're just doing things in isolation. And if we also don't give them time to read, they're not going to be successful. And, you know, I almost want to ask Holly what she thinks. Holly, people are having trouble in the field deciding how to structure their literacy block. I've spoken to Faith about this. She's consulting in a school in Long Island. They prioritize the learning how to read and write very much in K-2, with, of course, knowledge building immersed in there as well.
And and it's still a work in progress. Yeah. You know, we're still working on this. Yes.
I need to ask you something. So do you feel in K-2, it should be a 50-50 split on how we spend time between knowledge building and learning how to read? Or do you think that the balance could be a little bit different? Because what I'm worried about is that we're going to have a lot of kids because we're doing so much of the other stuff, which is important. Mm-hmm. But learning how to read is not that easy for a lot of the kids right now, from what I'm seeing.
Agreed. So in our program, the way that we recommend that the time is spent is with a 90-minute reading block, which is what's most common in Florida and in lots of other places. And that's not a literacy block, that's a reading block. So generally, there's more time set aside for writing beyond that. And ideally, you are incorporating and integrating across the different areas, including writing within that. But if you've got 90 minutes for reading, what we recommend is that you have 30 minutes that you spend on your foundational skills, whole class instruction. You spend another 30 minutes on your language comprehension, knowledge building instruction. And then you spend 30 minutes differentiating. So giving kids more foundational skills, more language and knowledge building based on their needs, on what you have observed and what you have measured as far as what kids are needing. If they need more vocabulary time, spend that there. If they need more decoding and encoding practice, spend that there, but base it on assessment and determine, you know, make it true data-based instructional decision-making for that differentiation time. A lot of teachers that I talk with, when they hear small group, they immediately go in their minds to, I have this amount of time and this number of kids, so I'm going to divide my time up equally and divide my kids up equally and rotate kids through. And that's what small group looks like. And that is literally the opposite of differentiation. Mm-hmm. So what we recommend for differentiating for foundational skills is assessing the specific skills that you just taught and determining based on how far kids are from mastery. Some kids will have mastered it very quickly. We don't expect mastery after just the initial lesson, but some kids will. Other kids will need a little bit more instruction. Some kids will need a lot more instruction. And you base your small group on that. And it might be that you spend 10 minutes a day with that group that needs a lot more support, and 5 minutes, three times a week for the kids who need a little bit more. And for the others, you just spend a couple of minutes, maybe two times a week. And so you're truly differentiating everything about the instruction. You're providing longer time with the kids who need the most, more practice opportunities for the kids who need the most, more days a week for the kids who need the most. And you're really focusing in on the specific skills that they need. So if that 30 minutes of differentiation, if you have kids who need a lot of foundational skills instruction, then it may not be a 50-50 balance. If you've got kids who need a lot more language development, it might not be a 50-50
balance. So that's interesting, Holly. So from what I'm seeing in the field, a lot of these programs are requesting that teachers spend like 45 minutes on the knowledge building reading portion, 45 minutes on the writing program. And what I see is very fatigued kids, tired. Their brains are not on fire after like doing a 30-minute foundations lesson or a phonics lesson, then 10 minutes of Hegarty, then possibly shared reading with the geode. And then it's a lot. So, mm-hmm. I think that comes back to the conversation of being responsive to your data and also realizing that these curriculums are just programs. We still have to make adjustments just because it says 45 minutes and 45 minutes just for that. What if it's not working for your kids?
So I want to jump on what Judy's talking about, and I said this before, Holly, you had said in your webinar that, there's no secret panel putting their stamp of approval.
Right.
On, we both listened to the science versus the snake oil. And so there's no secret panel putting their stamp of approval on this, yet we're looking to What Works Clearinghouse. We're looking to ESSA. We're looking to Ed Reports. We're looking now to this Curriculum Insight Project. What are we supposed to believe here? Because I have my own feelings. I know Judy does too, but I think everyone wants to hear what someone like you would have to say in terms of this, especially you put it out, science versus snake oil. So I'm really interested to hear what you say about these panels, about who exactly is doing the evaluating, how it's being judged. What's the vetting process? I mean, I'm confused. I'm really confused by this.
Well, it's such a great question, and it's not a simple answer.
I know.
There are multiple entities that do review programs. What Works Clearinghouse, that, as you mentioned, is operated by the Institute of Education Sciences, which is the research arm of the U.S. Department of Ed. And they have probably the most rigorous standards for the quality of the studies that have been done. And so that's what they're interested in, is looking at, really, for the most part, they just want to have randomized control trials, which is kind of the gold standard of research evidence for the effectiveness of a program. And if you don't have that, then there are other types of studies that can qualify to be reviewed, but all of the expectations are super, super rigorous, usually something that can only be accomplished by having a research grant to do an evaluation of a program. So What Works Clearinghouse, I think, started out to be or what I was hoping it started out to be, was kind of an FDA for education, right? To get any kind of food or drug on the market, you have to get approval that it's your, that what you're providing is safe and effective. And the FDA has very rigorous controls over that. And you really can't sell some things, or at least you can't sell them without very careful labeling. And so in the Science or Snake Oil webinar, that I told the story of Clark Stanley, the original snake oil salesman, who was brought down by that initial version of the FDA, the Bureau of Chemistry, because his snake oil didn't have anything that would do the things that it said. Well, we are seeing that in education now. And so having an entity like What Works Clearinghouse is great, except to even have something reviewed by What Works, the standard is way up here for what kinds of studies they'll even look at. What I wish they would do is look at programs that have different kinds of studies and give more information about what the results of those studies tell us. And what they don't tell us, that if the quality of the study isn't as rigorous as what they want for their for what they're going to review, well, what are the problems with the studies, and what cautions should we take in interpreting the results of those studies because of whatever methodological flaws they might have? Most studies are flawed, and there's something that we have to kind of take into consideration. And most peer-reviewed articles reporting on studies, they will say, here are the limitations of this research. And I think that What Works could serve as a true clearinghouse for educators and practitioners to help them understand, these are the things that the studies of this particular program tell us, and these are the things that we still don't know because the studies haven't been designed in a way that can show us that. A randomized control trial is extremely difficult to pull off because nobody wants to be in the control group, right? And you have to recruit people and then randomly assign them and to agree to say, okay, I'll participate, but I know I might not get anything. That's a big commitment, especially if we're talking about a program where a study might take an entire school year. You don't want to be in the control group. So it's not that it's impossible. Lots of researchers do pull them off, but to meet the What Works Clearinghouse is really challenging. Then you have other entities like Evidence for ESSA, which also do a good job of looking at the quality of the evidence. But their reports are really confusing for teachers because what they report is the strength of evidence, not the strength of the program. So in that webinar, the Science or Snake Oil webinar, I used the example of LLI. LLI has had several pretty well-designed studies of its efficacy. And so Evidence for ESSA gave it a strong rating for its evidence. But if you look at that same chart, it also gives its effect size. Mm-hmm. Its effect size was a 0.13.
Especially in the foundational skills.
Right. Its effect size was almost as though there was not a teacher in the room, right? it was so small, mm-hmm, that who would want to use a program with that small of an effect size? But I got a promotional email from LLI trying to sell me LLI, which is kind of funny in and of itself, but it said rated strong. Like, no, the program, mm-hmm, wasn't rated strong. The evidence, the quality of the study was strong. So we have very strong evidence that it doesn't really work. And so that's part of the kind of that knowledge of the consumer that has to fill in those gaps. What is the rating actually telling us? And what does that mean? What are those numbers mean? Not everybody learned that in their teacher preparation program. And so that's a problem. So we have What Works Clearinghouse, we have Evidence for ESSA, and then you mentioned Ed Reports. That's a another entity that has come under some fire recently, because there are programs that actually do have evidence and studies supporting their efficacy that are rated not so good. And there are studies that have no studies. I mean, there are programs that have no studies that are rated all green. And so the in that case, it's really all about the rubrics that are being used and the knowledge of the reviewers. So Ed Reports, I don't know a whole lot about how they operate behind the scenes, but my understanding is that they hire practicing educators and train them to do their reviews and to use their rating scales or rubrics. And they have different like gateways that you have to get through to get a rating. But they aren't researchers doing the reviews. So there aren't people who can necessarily evaluate the quality of any studies of it, but they're not really looking at the studies so much as looking at the program itself and what it includes and what it doesn't include. And so each of these entities is kind of looking from a different lens, a different angle, with different intentions of how their reports or their ratings are to be used. And it mostly just ends up with it being really confusing for the consumer in the long run. So it's pretty frustrating. And I know teachers, especially, you know, when they see their district leaders not knowing much more than they do and making decisions based on these kinds of reports, it's really frustrating.
Well, yes, it's very frustrating, especially now there's this curriculum project that's coming out, right? That's a new one. What about that entity? I mean, what do we know about that that's different from what was before? And, you know, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, the one thing I really do appreciate most about the Curriculum Insight Project is that, you know, all of the work that the reporting that Emily Hanford did and Sold a Story and all our podcasts that preceded that really helped us understand that there were some programs that were very widely used that were just super ineffective, that were not getting the job done at all. And so there's been a mass exodus away from those programs. But people are running away from those programs and into the arms of what's out there, right? The big publishers that are putting out these so-called comprehensive programs that are supposed to address all your needs. And what's happening is that those programs, those publishers have really good sales teams. They're out there convincing people that what they have is good. And some of them are solid and some of them are horrible. And there's a lot in between. And so I think my understanding of the Curriculum Insight work, and I've talked with the people leading that just a little bit to kind of try to understand, they're looking now at those programs that have gotten greens on Ed Reports because they cover all of the, you know, they tick off all the boxes. They've got all of the pillars of reading addressed, whatever that means, right? But they're still not getting good results, or they have other problems with them. The usability piece is something that nobody's really looked at. And they are going to be looking at that, is how usable is a program. I truly appreciate that, because that to me is what teachers are hungry for, is give me something that I can use, I can figure it out, I can implement it without a whole lot of training and figuring out how to sort through all these materials. And, you know, they used an example of one program, I forget which one it was, but it was the first grade online resources for this program. There were 7,500 resources, which I just did the math in my head. I can't tell you if it was accurate, but I think it worked out to around 40 things a day if you used all of it, which clearly you're not going to use all of that. But that same program had zero guidance for teachers about what was essential and what was optional, or, you know, what should be used under what circumstances with which students and so on. So that put a lot of the onus on the classroom teacher to figure out. And that's just not fair. They don't have that kind of time. If you want them to be effective, you've got to give them usable programs. That was one of the things that I guess I'm probably most proud of with UFLY, is that we spent 2 years getting it right before we even decided to sell the program. You know, we started the program as in response to a request from one school for help with their phonics instruction. And we had been relying on teacher knowledge building for years and not seeing it translated into changes in classroom practice. So just one day, we were right at the beginning of the pandemic. The, you know, UFLY staff were at home. They couldn't be in school. So I said, let's plan lessons for this school. Let's just create phonics lesson plans. And we gave them to the teachers. We just started with the first 3 or 4 weeks of school. We said, here, try these out. They said, well, this is great, but this is awful. You know, and they told us what they liked, what they didn't like. We completely changed the structure. Our original lessons were, here, do this. It'll take you 45, 50 minutes. They said, no, divide it up. Give us 30 minutes a day for 2 days for a lesson. I said, okay. We listened to teachers, what they thought made it easier to implement and more effective with their kids. And by mid-year, they really didn't have any more suggestions for us. They said, now you've got a structure that really works. And then we started looking at, well, does it really work? Let's look to see if kids are actually learning the way we want them to. And it really wasn't until the next year when we had it implemented district-wide for half a year and saw really great mid-year scores that we said, maybe we ought to try sharing this with other teachers, getting it out there and publish this as a manual. It didn't even occur to us before that. And that's kind of the exact opposite. A big publisher is, what can we sell? Then maybe down the road, let's see if it's effective after it's already out there on the market.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, I think that's the big problem, that, you know, the way you're doing it, the way you did it was, all right, we're going to pilot this, take in what people think about it, revise, keep working with it until you have a good product. So, Judy, one of the things that I know that we've talked about is usability of a big program. And it doesn't matter which program it is. Every time we're on Facebook, we tag each other when we see teachers complaining about the program. And, you know, and it could be, you know, I don't even have to say the names of the programs. It doesn't even matter. It's just the idea that I think every program will have flaws in it. But it doesn't seem as though what you're talking about happened with these big publishers. So, Judy, when we were having our conversations about this and we would tag each other, see, here's another teacher saying that there's a problem. Here's another teacher that's saying there's a problem. So now I was asking Holly about these panels, hoping that somebody would put a stamp of approval on something. But, you know, we don't know what kind of background the people have. We know we could look into it, but we really don't understand the process. And so what are your thoughts about what's happening now with these approval panels?
I'm worried. If I have to be really honest, I'm extremely worried. I trust no one right now at all. I do trust the manual that I have from Holly Tomorrow I'm modeling a lesson where foundation's building, but I still use the U-Fly passages all the time. I'm really worried. I think that it's concerning that people start to idolize people in literacy rather than to really think about what's best for kids. Yes. And just because you see the same old face is on a panel or is on a project, that doesn't mean the program is good. I don't think usability is very important, but for me, what's really important is data. What is the data showing? How long has the program been in the field and shown that it's effective? Has it been shown to be effective in the same demographic neighborhoods, poor districts, wealthy districts, and so forth? It's very easy to say something is working great in some place, and then you go to another district and it's not working.
I'm giving you a big cheers, Judy, because that's exact. You took the words right out of my mouth. I see Holly smiling and nodding.
And you know what? And you know what? I'm going to even go further. So, you know, I always like to research things. That's my passion. I love information. I love to, and I don't easily trust a lot of people. That's who I am. I'm always, you know, what is the
trust
data?
Trust me, honey.
Sometimes. No, I always trust you. I do.
Sometimes.
You're my partner in crime. But, you know, I was looking at a website of a very large state that I'm not going to name. And it said that there was a program, which everybody says it's a curriculum, but it's a program was studied for 1 year and that the study was done in the suburbs and it was discontinued because of COVID. Now, that's not really great evidence for me. So I want to see more evidence on all these companies because right now the salespeople are winning. Oh, I have the best decodable. All right. You know what? Some of them suck. Building programs aren't thinking enough about kids lifting the words off the page. So I am very cautious, and I'm very cautious because I feel like it's a popularity contest right now where people are thinking about their own agenda rather than thinking about kids. Because let me tell you, Faith, you inspired me. I bought a lot of decodables, and guess what? They didn't cost a lot of money. And I'm teaching a lot of kids how to read privately because a lot of the schools aren't doing a really grand job. So, you know what? Watch out, people. Beware, be smart, and think about the kids rather than your pocket.
So, you know, that's the issue. What Judy just said is the issue. Now, I could tell you, I've used a lot of different programs. If you look in my office, I have books galore. I have one of your books, Holly, from 20 years ago that you're holding, I know. And this was a book that had things now that we would say, okay, we're not using anymore. That's what happens in science. Things change, we change. So I have a ton of books here and tons of things. And I could tell you some of my favorite things that I have are free or inexpensive. And, you know, what's probably the best thing I use is paper, pencil, chalk, chalkboard, dry erase marker, dry erase board. You know, and then things that I've had that's out there for free. Like I have this friend, Don Potter, who's been around for years, and I, you know, I know him for a long time. And he put out this free program, Blend Phonics, that's out there on his website, completely free. And, you know, his books are inexpensive. And then for intervention, I always talk about the Word Wasp and the Hornet books. And those are inexpensive for intervention and for older kids. Your book, Holly, The U-Fly Foundations, is incredible. The Sounds Right that I'm using now in a school district had great training. And it's one manual. That's the whole program. It's one manual and give the kids dry erase boards and markers. But it's the training that added to some of the cost, but not so expensive. And I could tell you, I could keep going on and on about this, that it's not about the cost of the program and not about the bells and whistles. So again, you know, I think we have people out there where there is a conflict of interest. And it's kind of scary now on social media when you look around and you see people that are kind of steering the conversation. And some of them have never been in a classroom. Some of them have completely different careers. You know, they'll write about this, but they're not doing the work. And or, you know, they proclaim to be really expert in this. And you have to wonder about a conflict of interest as well. So how do people sort through this? So now you mentioned about sorting through programs when people can look this up and look at the research. How do we sort through people on social media? I don't know how else to say it. Like how do you kind of tell when people are steering the conversation?
That's a really good question.
Silence.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I get some of that, you know, in terms of, there's like a, you know, kind of a mystique around certain people in the field. And, you know, and I'll see teachers at a conference and they're like, oh my goodness, it's Holly Lane. And it's like, I'm flattered by that. Absolutely. But it's also very strange. And I feel like, don't be out there worshiping.
Yes, idol worship.
A better term.
I've said this thing, the idol worship is ridiculous.
Yeah, yes. it's really strange.
Yes.
And, you know, I adore teachers. I am a teacher at heart. And I feel like that will always be important to me, that teachers are comfortable with what I'm asking them to do, that it's something that they feel is doable and most importantly, gets at what they care most about, which is helping their kids. Right. But I feel like there is a lot out there of just following people. Don't believe everything I say. I might just be full of crap sometimes.
We have a BS button for you.
Right? I mean, don't just take my word for anything. You know, go and learn how to look at evidence yourself. And, you know, and it doesn't just apply to me. I would say that about anybody, you know, in the field. Don't just trust what they say. You know, that's one thing when, really often in these big Facebook groups, what I will see happen is, when somebody asks for the research for somebody to back up their assertion with, the research is almost always a book or a blog post or a website. It's hardly ever actually research that people are using to back up the assertions that they're making. And so that element of it, I think, is problematic. I think we need to make sure that the teachers understand what is research and what is not. And, you know, I don't expect anybody, I mean, I can barely look at some of these studies and understand all of the complex statistics that people are describing in the results section. That's okay. You don't have to. If you're looking in high quality, reputable sources, reputable journals, and it has gone through peer review, then it really shouldn't be your job as a consumer to then question, is this journal doing their job or not? If it's a reputable journal with a high impact factor and those kinds of things, then you should be able to put some trust in the research that's published in that journal. And you can look at the abstract of an article or the discussion section of an article, and you can understand that and what they're saying and what their findings are. Go there. Don't go to me. Don't go to another person that you just heard their name out there a lot. That's, it's not a healthy way to operate in the field. We need to look at the evidence, not the people.
Couldn't agree more. You know, I think that my BS radar goes up, you know, and I'm just like, you know, I need the BS detector because it's just, there's so much flying around here that it's really annoying to look at this. And I just want to say one of our episodes coming up will be with our friend Nate Joseph again. And the topic is going to be...
And Stacey Bain.
And Stacey Bain as well, who is, I think, a president of a Reading League chapter. And we're going to continue this conversation about curriculum and trying to sort through some of this, because it's just not fair that people are left to do this. And as we were talking about, there are these treasures, these free and inexpensive treasures that maybe they didn't have this big study done, but it works. It just works. It's worked for years and years, and kids learn even without this huge study done. You know, I
think, but we have to be careful with that too, because sometimes what seems like it's working is not really producing the kind of evidence that we think. We see this child who is successful after having been unsuccessful. Well, there's lots of things that could have gone into that child's success. It may have been that program that they just finally got, or it may be the accumulation of all of the learning they did from these other programs now is finally crystallizing. And we don't know that just by our anecdotal evidence. So I will throw out a little cautionary note there. We tend to, you know, believe what we see with our own eyes. Of course we do, right? But that is such a tiny, tiny, little tiny bit of evidence. We need more evidence before we can say something works. And even if you've been successful with it repeatedly, it doesn't mean it's going to work, you know, as Judy said, other settings with other populations.
Right. And it's also teacher knowledge as well.
And that comes back to my days of reading recovery. So I was a reading recovery practitioner. You know, some of my kids discontinued and were quote unquote successful, but, you know, that was just perception then. If I really thought about if they were great decoders, they could have been way better, right? So that experience, they discontinued and met the criteria. But if I would have looked at how their decoding skills were years later, now that I really know how to teach decoding way better, the reality might have not been as grand as I thought it was for those kids that discontinued, which means, quote unquote, they accomplished the criteria to be a lifelong reader. And most kids didn't. So that's why I shifted towards structured literacy.
Can I tell you a little story about UFI and reading recovery?
Oh, my God. Is it juicy?
So, well, it was just, I thought, really interesting. So when we first started doing, you know, older iterations of what we're now calling UFI Foundations, I mean, it was 20 some years ago we were doing this. Obviously, it's evolved quite a bit over that time. But we got a federal grant to study that original version. And one of the several studies that was addressed in this grant was to compare our UFLY one-on-one tutoring with reading recovery one-on-one tutoring. And, you know, this was kind of intimidating. I was a, you know, baby professor at the time. And at the time, reading recovery was the end all and be all that everybody was, you know, talking about as the best intervention. And so the way that reading recovery was operating in the school district where we got permission to study it, we had in one school, there were two teachers sharing a first grade classroom. One tutored half the day while the other one was teaching the class, and then they switched roles. And then in the other school, they had somebody who just tutored all day long. She was just a reading recovery teacher. So we were going to compare our tutoring to their tutoring. Our tutoring was implemented by parents from the school who were there every day, really reliable volunteers, but we paid them like $10 an hour to do tutoring. And there were three reading recovery teachers and three parents. And, you know, reading recovery, you have a year of training or something. And these parents had a week of training. And so my goal was to have maybe one measure where we were, you know, not statistically different from the reading recovery kids. And then about halfway through the study, the one reading recovery teacher that tutored all day long got really sick, and she had to take medical leave for the rest of the school year. Well, in a reading recovery program, that means, oops, you can't just replace a reading recovery teacher really quickly. So it basically blew the study up. We didn't have enough kids complete to be able to do our statistical comparisons. But we did still look at the results of the kids that the other two teachers finished and the kids that the parents finished tutoring. And we were actually the same scores on all but one measure, and the one measure we did better than reading recovery. So with 1 week of training using this other little tutoring model that we had developed, we were able to get the same results as this program that was supposedly the end all and be all. So I wish that I had published that in some form, even though it had fallen apart, because we still learned a lot from it. And the biggest thing I learned was, gosh, reading recovery is not the end all and be all after all. That, you know, if these parent volunteers with a week of training can get comparable results, then why are we spending so much money on this program? And that was many years before all of the subsequent studies found that it wasn't being effective. But it was a real eye-opener for me to just look at it. And, you know, again, anecdotally, lots of people had seen good things happen to kids who were in reading recovery. So that anecdotal evidence just kept reinforcing that this is a great program. But when we looked at it on a larger scale, it turns out it kind of fell apart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Quick question for you. Mm-hmm. And this is actually from one of our listeners who wanted me to pose the question to you. And it was, with UFLY, is it good for kids with dyslexia? Did you find that there's a difference in terms of using it for kids with dyslexia, or should it be used differently? And I thought that was a really good question, because
it is a good question.
Are using it really more as a whole class type of program? And I don't know, you know, I didn't have an answer. So
UFLY Foundations in its exact form, we have not studied, but with kids with dyslexia. But again, we have these prior iterations where the changes are minimal from one iteration to another over the years. We have a prior iteration that we've called UFLY Intensive, and we've only ever used this in our pre-service teacher prep program. So we had a dual cert program where our students graduated certified in elementary and special ed. And as part of that, they had a summer practicum where they worked with kids with dyslexia and implemented UFLY Intensive. And essentially, they were doing all of the activities that we now have in UFLY Foundations, just in a slightly different order. And it was more individualized in terms of, you know, what they were focusing on, which concepts was based on their assessment data. So those were the main differences. It was different order and more individualized focus on the and sequence of the concepts. But in the study that we did on UFLY Intensive, we got significant gains in 3 weeks in a summer program. So is it effective? Absolutely. our students who are currently in our dyslexia certificate program at UF. They are using UFLY Foundations, but in the intensive structure. It's just a slightly different lesson structure. You organize the, it has basically all of the same features, just organized in a different way. And most of them use the UFLY manual to plan their lessons for their kids with dyslexia. So
that's can I ask Holly a question? Holly, so I see a lot of people posting online that, you know, UFLI focuses a lot on the foundational skills. And how is that enough? And are you guys considering creating a knowledge building portion, since you guys have been so successful with the foundational skills? I mean, I swear by the work that you have. I mean, those slides, God bless. And the fact that they're free, amazing. So is it something you guys are thinking about for the future? Or what do you recommend if people use UFLI for their knowledge building portion of the day?
So we're doing what I wish other publishers would do, or would do. And that is, we're staying in our lane. We know how to teach phonics really, really well. We get tremendous results with foundational skills. There are other people who have developed programs to develop language and knowledge really, really well. And I would much rather see somebody pair UFLY with one of the better programs to end up with something comprehensive that's going to be kind of the best, as opposed to a program that's attempting to do it all, but does none of it well. Does that make sense?
So is a core program necessary?
A comprehensive program? Core, I mean, to me, core is, like, we're core. Like, we,
I mean, core meaning like you buy a program that's supposed to do it all. Is a core program that does it all, like in a box, all the pillars that we talk about, is it necessary to have something like that? Or is it possible to piece together what we feel is the best of the best?
I think the latter is the best choice.
Yeah,
right?
I do too.
I mean, given that I don't know of a comprehensive program that is at the top, right, in each area. I mean, where UFLY is being used, basically every so-called comprehensive program has at least some districts in the United States who have found the skills, the foundational skills component inadequate and have substituted UFLY. Some programs much more commonly than others, but pretty much all of those programs we have heard from districts that have gotten UFLY foundations already have a program that's supposed to include foundational skills, but they have found it inadequate and they're trying UFLY in its place in those skills. I do feel like there are some really solid programs out there that do that language and knowledge building component really well. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that any of them do it all that well, right? Mm-hmm. So I would rather see you piece together things that work really well. And it doesn't have to be UFLY. There's some other really strong phonics programs out there too.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, 95% group has great stuff, right? There are lots of other programs out there that are really solid. Mm-hmm. But having something that someone who knows that area really well and somebody who knows this area really well and connect that
to make
it better. Yes, it would be wonderful if there were one program that integrated it all beautifully and did it all super well. I just haven't seen that program.
I think so. Nell Duke is trying to do something like
that. Well, if anybody can do it, she can.
Yeah. So on that note, let's just wrap up. Judy, do you have any last questions or thoughts?
Thank you, Holly. I'm so honored to meet you today. And we, the literacy world, appreciate your resources, and we appreciate that they're free online. I put your passages in a binder. Teachers put post-its on it, and they ask for copies and so forth. Keep doing what you do. We appreciate you. The buzz about what you do is always so positive, and you deserve it.
Thank you.
What a nice comment. And I feel the same way. I didn't mention it at the beginning, but I actually know Holly for a long time. Also, Reading First, they say it all the time. I met some of the greatest people through Reading First, and Holly was one of our speakers here on Long Island, and she came to the Brooklyn conference, and I actually booked Holly for speaking engagements.
And I have to say, it was driving me nuts. I would see Faith do these podcasts, and I would say, gosh, she looks so familiar. Mm-hmm. Maybe she's just one of those people that is that just seems like you know them. But yeah, she actually was familiar to me. That was why.
Yeah. So, you know, and you've always been gracious and so knowledgeable
and down to earth.
Absolutely. And we really appreciate you doing this and taking the time to be with us. And what's really cool, we have a new website. So Judy doesn't have to go through the whole spiel about how to contact us anymore. All you have to do is go to theliteracyview.com. Yay.
Hey, Faith, you're stealing my part.
I'm so sorry. I took your line.
Yeah. So follow us, literacyview.com, and join our Facebook group. It's on there. You know, Real Teachers Letting Loose. Also, write some good comments to us. We really appreciate it on Apple Podcasts. And on our website, we now have a new feature. You can contact us directly for any of your questions, concerns, comments, requests. So we're up and running. We're really happy about the literacy community we've created.
Yep. And just to let everybody know, this is March Madness, and we are having so many special guests this month, and it's going to be rocking. So I hope everybody stays with us. And that's it. We appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.